It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Starbucks announced it will increase wages for non-unionized employees after a string of successful union votes at outlets of the coffee chain. We'll check out the impact of unionization on non-union workers and some of the rules behind these union drives and a company's response. First, in the leaked draft opinion that would overturn Roe v. Wade, Justice Samuel Alito writes that, quote, "Our decision concerns the constitutional right to abortion and no other right. Nothing in this opinion should be understood to cast doubt on precedents that do not concern abortion," end quote. Still, many pro-abortion rights activists and others have raised concerns that if Justice Alito's reasoning stands when the court hands down its decision this summer, many other rights could be at risk. That includes same-sex marriage and relationships, access to contraception, and interracial marriage. The Roe v. Wade decision argues that under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, people have the right to seek an abortion. That amendment has been used to establish many other rights, such as the right for same-sex couples to marry, the right to use contraception, and the right for consenting adults to have sexual intimacy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have concerns that if this ruling as written stands, it could bring other rights, other past rulings into question on things like same-sex marriage, interracial marriage, other big Supreme Court decisions over the years? Join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Benish is an associate professor and chair of political science at UW-Milwaukee. Her work focuses on the Supreme Court. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, in this leaked opinion, Justice Alito said, hey, no, this is just about abortion, not any rights unrelated to abortion. Can you talk about that part of his, again, draft ruling and how it could or could not apply to these other precedents I mentioned?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Justice Alito is very careful to note in a couple of places in the draft opinion that this applies only to abortion. But I think it is fairly simple for him to say that, and a little bit harder to argue that some of the holdings in this draft opinion would not also apply to same-sex sexual intimacy, contraception, same-sex marriage, those kinds of issues. The court in this draft opinion really delve into the history of the right to abortion. And their argument is that the right to abortion is not protected in the Constitution, and only those things that we can say are deeply rooted in our nation's history are so protected by that 14th Amendment's liberty interest. Once they dive into the history, then they find that there have been abortion statutes on the books since the 1800s. And so for that reason, the right to abortion isn't something that would be protected. You might be able to tell then that if we were to apply that same reasoning to something like same-sex marriage or even same-sex sexual intimacy, we would also not find there to be any sort of historically rooted right.
Can you talk about the use of the 14th Amendment in these kinds of cases where, in effect, they say, hey, we, the federal government, via the court system, is going to say, hey, you, the states, you can't restrict these rights, even though they're not enumerated in the Constitution. These are some liberties that you don't have the right to overrule. Can you talk about that as a basis for a lot of these decisions we're talking about?
Yes. For a long time, the Supreme Court has interpreted the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause as conferring substantive rights. That's not uncontroversial, and that's something that Justice Alito talks about in his draft opinion, because the words of the 14th Amendment protect process, right? So you can't be deprived of life, liberty, life, liberty, or property without due process, meaning you have to go through certain steps, that the government would have to go through certain steps to take those things away from you. But the court has over time found that anything that we deem to be intrinsic to our ordered liberty, something that without which our nation doesn't have the characteristics that we think our nation must have, anything that are fundamental rights are also protected under that due process clause of the 14th Amendment. And so something like privacy, which we all sort of expect as a human right and expect in terms of our ability to choose how to live our lives, is not something that's in the Constitution, but that the justices have found to be implicit in our system and something that is fundamental to our experience as citizens. So anything that the court has deemed to be intrinsic to our ordered liberty, something that's fundamental, deeply rooted in our nation's history, has been deemed to be protected by that 14th Amendment's due process clause, even though it's nowhere explicitly stated in the Constitution.
Now, Justice Alito, again, says this applies only to abortion. We're not talking about this other stuff. Some people have pointed toward Justice Alito's dissent in the Obergefell decision. That's the same-sex marriage one. Making exactly, if I understand this correctly, I'm not a lawyer, making exactly this argument that, no, the 14th Amendment shouldn't apply here. So could that come up in a future challenge, say, a state law restricting, again, same-sex marriage?
Yeah, that's exactly the argument, right? That if we are to take this position, which is also shared by Justice Thomas, was shared by Justice Rehnquist in past courts, that the 14th Amendment confers only that procedural due process, then anything that doesn't have a constitutional textual basis would be open for state decision-making. So, of course, the draft opinion doesn't take away the right to abortion. It just finds that it's not protected by the Constitution and so leaves open the question to the states to make those decisions. That would also be the case with same-sex marriage.
Sarah Benish is with us, associate professor and chair of political science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at this draft Roe v. Wade decision that would, if it stands, if it goes into the summer, would overturn Roe v. Wade and what it means for other precedents that people may have taken for granted. Same-sex marriage, the right this idea that states can't restrict contraception, for example, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jack is with us in Milwaukee. Jack, hello.
Hello. The reason I'm calling is that going back on a little different angle on this subject, one thing that's bothering me is that we also have constitutional guarantees in the practice of religion, freedom of religion. And I'm not a Muslim, for example, but I do understand that they don't consider a fetus really a whole person until the end of the first trimester, when you receive the number of breaths you're going to breathe, your talents, and your soul. And so the question that I'm getting into here is what's the foundational argument on the part of the court on freedom of religion versus interfering in this whole process of telling people we may or may not have an abortion, either at state level or federal.
Jack, thanks for the call. Sarah, I've seen some people argue, people who support abortion rights, for example, who argue there may have been better avenues to pursue it. Jack saying a religious liberty angle.
So I'm struggling to try to think of the ways in which the religious liberty would play into the abortion question. Obviously, this is a highly moralistic issue about where life begins. And that is something that Alito explicitly says in his draft that he's not going to take part in the discussion over. And the Supreme Court has generally kept itself away from that decision. But of course, the statute at issue does call the fetus an unborn human being. And if states were to choose to delineate the fetus as an unborn person, then we'd have to get into a question of whether or not the Constitution confers any sort of rights on unborn fetuses as people. And that's another, entire can of worms. But I think in terms of the freedom of religion, in many ways, it's not implicated here because no one's being forced into any sort of decisions about abortion. And so I'm not exactly clear on where those things lie, though obviously a lot of opposition to abortion is religious in nature.
Thanks for the call, Jack. Deborah joins us now in Minnesota. Deborah, hi.
Hi. I'm concerned about Alito's saying that there is no history of abortion in the U.S. At the time the Constitution was written and ratified and the Bill of Rights was added, it was just common practice that a woman could end a pregnancy up until the point of quickening. And the Ninth Amendment should protect that right because it says that the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage rights retained by the people. So why didn't he take that into consideration?
Deborah, thanks for the call. That historical argument from Justice Alito, I have seen other people, Sarah, make the case that there is some tradition of abortion being allowed in the early United States. What do you think of what Deborah had to bring up?
Yeah, I think that's exactly true, that there were abortions allowed. And in fact, this question of quickening was one that Justice Alito talked about in the draft, and many states grappled with as they had their various iterations of abortion laws over time. But that's not exactly the focus that Alito is putting on this question of whether or not the due process clause includes a right to privacy or to an abortion, because what he's looking at is whether or not there's a deeply rooted history in this country of recognizing a right to abortion. So allowing for abortions, the fact that they existed at the founding, that's all true. His contention is that there's no deeply rooted right that's protected by the Constitution under that 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. Of course, Deborah pointed to the Ninth Amendment. That's where a lot of the justices over time have deemed the privacy protection to lie. But the majority of the court has really focused most of its attention on that 14th Amendment due process right. And the way Alito's reading it in the draft opinion, it has to have some evidence that it's deeply rooted in our nation's history, that right be fundamental in nature.
Deborah, thanks for that call. Sarah Benish is with us, associate professor and chair of political science at UW-Milwaukee, talking to us about other legal precedents that could be in question if Roe v. Wade were to be overturned. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As we've heard, same-sex marriage, access to contraception, interracial marriage, all rights established using in part the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause and the right to privacy. Are you worried that those rights could be at risk? Do you have questions for a guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up the conversation with Sarah Benish, associate professor and chair of political science at UW-Milwaukee, who studies the Supreme Court. We're talking about the draft decision leaked that would overturn Roe v. Wade and whether the ruling could affect other court precedents, lots of them potentially. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, another precedent that people bring up is the case of Loving versus Virginia. I think a 1967 decision that said, hey, states, you can't outlaw interracial marriage. Justice Alito looking for this historical guarantee. He looks at the timing of the 14th Amendment just after the Civil War. Could somebody make a case based on that, like, hey, interracial marriage wasn't the norm, wasn't necessarily allowed then, so we could challenge it now?
I suppose someone could make that case. I think that particular case is probably the hardest one to make, even under the Alito ruling. I think the idea that marriage has a deep root in our history is fairly clear, and so the right to marry is a very strongly recognized and fundamental right, even though, again, that's not in the Constitution. So I think it would be more difficult to make that case in terms of interracial marriage than to say make the case that this opinion would also have some ramifications for same-sex sexual intimacy, for example. So I think in those cases, the Supreme Court did much the same thing as Alito's doing here with Roe. So rather than recognizing and focusing on a right to privacy or a right to bodily integrity, Alito's really focusing on a right to abortion. In the same way, an earlier court in Bowers versus Hardwick focused on whether or not there was a fundamental right for homosexuals to engage in sodomy. And they found that there was no historical right, which is not surprising to anyone, right? When the court overturned that decision in Lawrence versus Texas, the court then instead focused on a fundamental right to sexual intimacy. And that was something that was far easier for them to find in our sort of historical context. So I think that, you know, that's a much closer corollary to what Alito is doing here with abortion than interracial marriage, although I don't think that this draft would be without implications for those kinds of questions.
Now, you also pointed us toward a ruling that I'm less familiar with on the right to refuse medical treatment, the case, a Cruzan case. I'm not. Could you tell us what that was and how it fits in here?
Yeah, I think that that case was really focused very carefully on this right to bodily integrity, and found that there is a fundamental right that does exist and is deeply rooted in history of a person to have bodily integrity, to be able to refuse medical treatment. And the court, the draft, I keep saying the court, this is a draft by Alito, doesn't talk about Cruzan in their draft opinion, and so sort of sidesteps this issue of this really fundamental and deeply historically rooted right that we have to control what goes into our body, what is done to our body, and those kinds of issues. And again, I think the focus on whether or not there's a deeply rooted fundamental right to abortion leads him to the conclusion in a way that focusing instead on a fundamental, deeply rooted right to bodily integrity would not.
Talking to Sarah Benish from UW-Milwaukee, looking at the leaked draft Roe v. Wade overturning ruling and what it might mean for other precedents in the U.S. Supreme Court. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Steve is with us in Chippewa Falls. Steve, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. You know, my question is about whether we can pass a law that essentially codifies abortion rights in the United States. And from what I can tell, most Americans would support that. But also you can make this to meet your today's topic, you know, to codify the right to gay marriage or any other one of these subjects that you're entailing. And my question is this: if a law is passed by Congress and the Senate and signed by the president, that's the law then, right? I mean, or does the Supreme Court have the ability to say, no, that's not the law? Because it seems to me that an abortion law, you know, something in the style of a European abortion law, could pass the Senate. We already have Murkowski and Collins bringing forth a potential law that more or less codifies Roe, with the exception of a very, very late-term abortion. And it seems to me that even my friends who are pro-life would, at some level, they'll be on board for like a 12 or 15. Oh, sorry, my daughter's here, but
that's okay.
I'm gonna let it go at that.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Sarah, I mean, part of the argument in the courts sometimes is, hey, this shouldn't be the courts doing this. This should be legislatures. But our caller raises the question, you know, if Congress says, yeah, abortion access has to be legal in all states, could a state still challenge that? And maybe a Supreme Court say, no, Congress, you can't do that.
I think the Congress certainly has the ability to consider that kind of legislation, provided it has the political will to pass it. And of course, we know that that will be difficult given the makeup of the Senate in terms of a filibuster-proof majority. And yes, the Supreme Court could then consider a challenge from, say, Texas or Oklahoma that suggests that that oversteps the federal government's power. And so then the Supreme Court would have to decide whether or not the federal government has the power to put forward that kind of a requirement. And of course, it would depend on what the wording of the requirement said and those kinds of things. But yeah, certainly the Supreme Court, through Justice Alito's draft, is talking a lot about the role of courts versus the role of legislatures. And their contention is that when the Constitution doesn't forbid something, that those are instances when the states and the elected representatives of the people need to be the ones to take action rather than the courts.
Thanks for that call. Sarah, on a wider note, one question here is, how willing is the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn precedent because the makeup of the court is different, saying, hey, the five of us think the seven justices back in 73 just plumb got this wrong? Do you see potentially this conservative majority on the court being a little quicker on the draw when it comes to being willing to do that kind of thing and overturn past rulings?
Yeah, that's good spotting, Rob, that it seems like there's a difference in the makeup of the court over time. And that's why we see differences in the makeup of the court's decisions over time. So it's absolutely the case that the ideology of the justices and their preferences and their interpretive strategies for the Constitution matter to the outcomes that they reach. And when a majority of the court is no longer in line with precedents that are, especially precedents that are old, the court really doesn't have a whole lot of a problem overturning those precedents. And so I think the fact that Roe versus Wade has stood as precedent with some revisions after Planned Parenthood versus Casey for all of these years without overturning, even though many solicitors general and many other litigants asked the court to overturn it, suggests that there's something special about the makeup of this court. And I think we are all recognizing that this court has a larger majority that is of conservative bent than any court we've had for a very long time. And so it's not at all surprising that this would be the time that they would start to look at overturning this precedent and others.
In just our last minute, what would it look like for new precedents to end up at the court? Will we see things like abortion has been over the last bunch of years, where states pass things to try to get them to the Supreme Court to put them to the test? Or can we see things like that, for example, with same-sex marriage?
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's every time we have a major and divisive public issue, there are litigants that are ready and waiting. There are attorneys that are ready and waiting to test the limits around whatever rules the court puts forward or whatever sort of situation the new court looks like it might be open to. And so this statute that the court is considering in Dobbs out of Mississippi is one of those statutes. There's a host of them across the country. There have been lots of regulations of abortion over time that have provided the opportunity for the court to make policy if it chose to do so. And so I think if this draft ends up to be the final one and Roe versus Wade is overturned, we'll see lots of test cases coming up through the courts to try to look at those other issues that you've raised as potentially being implicated by that decision.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Sarah Benish is an associate professor and chair of political science at UW-Milwaukee. Sarah studies the Supreme Court. She joins us today to talk about the possible broader legal implications of overturning Roe v. Wade and other Supreme Court precedents that might be at risk now. Coming up after the news, some stores in the coffee giant Starbucks have held successful union votes. The company has fired some organizers and now says it may give new benefits only to non-union workers. We'll look at the particular case of Starbucks and what it means for labor in general. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new study found that dog breed is not a strong predictor of dog personality. We'll take a look at those findings, and we want to hear what you have to say. If you match up with that finding, let us know right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, this month, thousands of college students in Wisconsin will cross the commencement stage, toss their caps, and trade campus life for new careers. As Rich Kramer reports, their prospects may be the best they've been in a decade.
The final months before college graduation can be a time of anxious job searches and streams of outgoing resumes. That's not the case for University of Wisconsin River Falls senior Nisi Obasi. The computer science and economics double major accepted an offer in August to become an investment analyst with Deutsche Bank in New York.
Now I've had the chance to really enjoy senior year without having that on my back.
Her advice to other students who may still be looking? Don't be afraid to counter an offer because you may have the upper hand.
I feel like negotiation skills, not a lot of people have them. So if you're given an offer for 100K, you just take it. You can get that to 120 and maybe throw on something on top if you just negotiate.
A spring survey by the National Association of Colleges and Employers shows businesses planning to boost college grad recruitment by more than 30% this year. That's the sharpest year-to-year increase in at least a decade.
This is an even hotter period for recruiters than they thought it was going to be in the fall.
Josh Kahn is assistant director of research for the group. He says recruiters are keenly aware of increasing competition for college grads. Their average starting salary is projected to top $50,000.
They know that they need to make good offers. They know that they need to raise wages and benefits to make attractive offers, competitive offers.
Taylor Schmidt-Franz is a senior at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire who landed a teaching job in April, just one day after her first interview.
February, March was kind of freaking out a little bit because I'm like, what am I doing with my life? Like, where am I going to live and all that stuff? But it feels really good. I feel ready to graduate now.
Even for seniors like UW Eau Claire's Hannah Leah, graduating without a job offer isn't that scary.
It's a really big job market right now, so I'm not really too concerned, especially because there's like a teacher shortage and they're paying people to go back to school to become teachers because they need them so bad.
Sam Mattson considers himself one of the lucky ones. The UW Eau Claire senior says he was asked to stay on after finishing up a student teaching job at a middle school in the city.
I think the biggest problem I have with it is you get into the classroom some more and you have current teachers that have been there for a long time saying, are you sure? Are you 100% positive? So you're second-guessing yourself more than you are the economy at this rate.
The national unemployment rate for those with at least a four-year degree was 2% in March. The unemployment rate for those with high school diplomas was twice that. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York reported a record pay gap last year of $22,000 between those with bachelor degrees and those without.
With a college degree, your ability employed is greatly enhanced.
That's Jim Kwopik, District Director for International Talent Recruiting Company, Robert Half.
Many employers are getting out ahead of the graduating class, and they're locking students in well before they graduate, unlike it's ever been.
But college enrollment has fallen since 2020. Elise Gould with the Economic Policy Institute says the pandemic added new roadblocks for many minority and lower income potential students who may not have been able to come up with tuition.
That's just not accessible to many people across the country.
As the race to recruit college students heats up, those watching the trends expect things to cool, though they're not sure how or when. In the meantime, those nearing graduation appear to be calling the shots in today's hiring economy, and they know it. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, Starbucks announced earlier this May that it will increase wages and training for non-unionized workers at corporate-owned locations. A growing number of Starbucks shops around the country are voting to unionize, including two spots in Wisconsin, Oak Creek and Plover, both of which officially voted last Friday. The Union Starbucks Workers United said in April that any benefits that specifically exclude unionized employees would be illegal. The group has filed more than 80 claims against Starbucks to the National Labor Relations Board so far. Starbucks is just one company, but a big one, and there's a lot of attention on the drive to unionize the coffee shops and what it could all mean for the rest of the labor market. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever been involved in a union or an organizing effort or as management negotiating with a union or a unionizing campaign? Are you part of this Starbucks story here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Childers is a professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, starting on this specific bit of news, the Starbucks owner, Howard Schultz, saying, yeah, we're going to have a wage increase and special training, but only for the non-unionized shop. So what do you make of that?
Well, again, I'm not sure that he's exactly quoted correctly, and I'm not sure which piece. I know there was a piece back in the Wall Street Journal in April. That would clearly be a violation of the National Labor Relations Act because the NLRA spells out pretty clearly that during the period where a union may be organizing to either threaten employees with adverse consequences or to promise benefits if they reject a union is absolutely against the law.
Right. That's the New York Times reported that Starbucks was saying they would raise pay at corporate-owned spots. They would not apply to the recently unionized stores. But the company says, well, hold on. We can't unilaterally change conditions because they're unionized stores. Do they have? Would that be an argument they could make?
So I think we've got to get a little bit into the weeds before we can get back between the lines. But the bottom line is that's actually sort of similar to this claim that's being made by the hospital board in terms of why they say they can't quote unquote bargain with the nurses, right? There's nothing that prevents bosses and workers from meeting and conferring. And again, there's nothing statutorial that would prevent them from offering the same benefits to these corporate stores that they are to the corporate stores who have conducted these union votes or the ones who have filed for election. It would only be illegal if they did it explicitly to try and influence the actions of the workers, either trying to organize or prior to when the vote occurs. So no, there's nothing illegal. I mean, again, think back to even when COVID flared up and for example, many people in the supply chain, grocery workers, for example, got hazard pay or bonus pay or heroes pay, however you wanted to frame it. You know, those are raises that were given in areas where there's collective bargaining. And again, that's a mandatory item of bargaining, but it's usually the case that a union is not going to reject when their workers are being offered more wages.
Now, zooming out a little bit, Starbucks is a big, high-profile company. Their individual shops, though, are pretty small, and we have this one-store-at-a-time unionization effort. It's getting a lot of attention, I think, just because of the prominence of the company. How big a part of the story of labor today in the United States is an organizing effort like this one at Starbucks?
Oh, I think it definitely contributes to the zeitgeist. And I mean, don't forget, we actually had the Colectivo workers with their Colectivo Collective, which actually is credited with inspiring the workers at the Buffalo Starbucks, who kind of got the ball rolling nationally. And yes, I think it absolutely encourages workers from the perspective that they see that, wait, you know, we could actually form a union here and then get the opportunity to be confer with the boss as equals at the bargaining table around, you know, these mandatory items like conditions of work, hours and wages. And yeah, I think, you know, the Gallup poll last year showed that union approval was at like near historic, like literally in decades has not been as high as it is right now. So yeah, it's no question that I think these kind of cues have been rippling across the economy. And I mean, you know, not to mention the whole kind of labor shortage and the increased individual power that workers are able to exert in the marketplace right now.
Yeah, how much is that that worker shortage, the labor shortage, tipping the balance in favor of somebody who wants their shop to be unionized?
You know, I think they're not necessarily related directly, but it just speaks to the idea that, you know, workers, I think, fundamentally or have, you know, in some ways people have reevaluated everything after COVID. And it's, what do you want from a job? What do you expect from work? You know, and again, I think, you know, consistently people kind of underestimate how bad their job is because of inertia. And it's when they finally start to say, you know, let me look at the opportunities that are out there. You've seen this sort of major, especially at the bottom half of the job market, this major sort of upheaval and sort of people trading up jobs.
I think when people think of the classic private industry union that might be a big factory, the auto plant, the meatpacking facility, whatever it might be, are we seeing a trend of more service sector unionization these days?
Well, I think there's no question. I mean, again, those are the jobs that are still here in our country, right? And they're the sectors of the economy that traditionally, going back to the, you know, 30s when the U.S. labor movement grew rapidly, were sectors that really weren't involved in that growth at that time. It was in what, you know, heavy manufacturing, et cetera. And yes, I think, you know, these kind of high tech jobs, we had, you know, the Raven organizing with the Activision quality assurance folks here in town. Obviously, we've mentioned the nurses, both the Meritor nurses were in a tough bargain last year and ended up at a strike vote and very near the strike deadline before they reached a settlement. You have the nurses at UW-Madison trying to reform their union. So, I mean, I think that, you know, workers still want a voice at work, and regardless of the sector of the economy. And those, again, those are the jobs that are here. They're still here in the United States. So,
talking to Michael Childers, professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison, talking to us about unions these days. Starbucks unions getting a lot of attention now as more stores get unionized, and how we'll get into how unions might affect those who aren't involved in them. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in a unionized workplace? Have you been in your life? What did you think about it? Do you want to be? Are you paying attention to these unionization drives, efforts at Amazon facilities getting attention? Starbucks, we've been talking about that. Colectivo, what our guest mentioned. Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Michael Childers, professor in the Department of Labor Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, looking at unions and workers' rights and the drive to unionize Starbucks stores, among others. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want your local coffee shop or other service establishment to be unionized? Do you think that is a good thing to see in your community? Have you been involved in a union, maybe even creating a union? Or if you're an employer, what do you think about efforts to unionize various workplaces? Call it at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experience at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael, an argument from unions over the years has been, you know, hey, if enough people are unionized, there's a spillover effect where wages go up to non-union employees in the same sector. Was that historically true? Is that something that still bears out?
It is something that still bears out. I mean, the difference in wages is, it depends on the specific sector, but around 10%. It's double digit increase. And it's not even just wages, it's the access to things like healthcare and especially some sort of a retirement plan. That's way higher representation for those benefits in workplaces where the workers have formed unions.
Let's talk about the playing field. There have been changes to labor negotiation rules over the years. Some advances in favor of union efforts, some pushing back on that over the years at the state and federal level. What do you see as the key parts of that story right now?
Well, I mean, there hasn't been any major reform to labor law literally since the 1950s. There's been many attempts. There's been many politicians run on platforms saying that they're going to change this or that aspect. Even this most recent administration ran on the idea that they were going to implement this Protecting the Right to Organize, or the PRO Act, and so far hasn't seen the light of day. You know, I think workers traditionally have always joined together when they feel like there's inequities. They're looking for equity and voice in their workplace, you know, in balance for the, you know, demand for efficiency from their employers. And again, regardless of how the laws change or come and go, that's kind of the steady constant.
That's the laws, but how about enforcement via things like the National Labor Relations Board?
Oh, well, certainly. I mean, that's the 5-member panel appointed by the president. So clearly the election matters from the respect that the president then has the ability, assuming that the Senate confirms their appointees, which could take us down a whole different rabbit hole. But it's certainly the case that especially over the last 3 administrations, we've seen both precedents get refined and then reversed and then re-reversed and then re-re-reversed in terms of, for example, the use of employers' email systems for union communications or for communicating with employees about the potential for joining a union. You know, under Obama, there was a decision where that was granted and said basically that's the equivalent of the water cooler of the 50s, right? And people de minimis used email for all sorts of purposes way beyond that of, you know, work. Then under the last administration, that got backed up and they said, well, no, we could try to, we can under certain circumstances if it's consistent that you prohibit it for all, you know, other, you can't sell Girl Scout cookies, you can, you know, that kind of thing. And then now it's the, you know, the new board has reinterpreted, basically putting back into place that standard that was in place from back in the Obama administration. So that's just one example.
Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ron is with us in Black River Falls. Ron, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Real quick question for your guest. And if you've covered this already, I apologize. I was a late comer. I'm curious if you've seen any shift in unions in terms of what their goals are. You know, in the past, unions were really about job protection, and in an environment and economy with lots of jobs and not enough workers, I'm wondering if the goals of the unions themselves are different, say better or more organization towards earning better wages for workers, things like that, rather than just trying to protect jobs. I'll take my answer off the air.
Ron, thanks for the call. Michael?
That's a great question. And I mean, I think we all come to work for money. And of course, wages are always the number one item on any survey that's taken of workers, whether in a bargaining unit or not. I would say that's, I want to unpack the question a little bit by just saying, you know, workers, you know, again, we all have our goals from the employment relationship in terms of, yeah, job security, reliable schedules. You know, we already talked about wages. We'll just stipulate that everybody wants more money. I guess I would say this. I mean, I think especially as you look at some of these organizing drives lately, workers want to make these jobs that you are, they're like family support, like a career, like the baristas, for example. You've heard the kind of this kind of, you know, the myth that, oh, well, that's, you know, these low wage jobs or starter jobs or for teenagers. And again, when you look at the data, people are in these jobs for the long term and generally have to work two or three of them to try to get by and make a living. And, you know, I just remember back from an interview with a Colectivo person that was part of their organizing. He said, we work here and we work here every day and we do a valuable service. And these are jobs that we would like to be able to stay in and also have a decent life. And I think from that respect, Ron's question is great because I really do feel like, again, kind of back to the conversation we were having about COVID and people rethinking what they want from the work relationship. I think these new unions are forming around the idea that, yeah, these jobs, you know, before it was get a job in manufacturing and those jobs are gone. It's, well, why can't these jobs be family supporting jobs?
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Michael Childers, professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison, looking at the cutting edge of unionization these days, a growing number of Starbucks shops, for example, unionizing. And Michael, one successful vote by organizing at an Amazon plant, which I think for some organizers has been kind of a holy grail. Others have fallen short, though. What are you watching for in this really huge employer that just got, in a lot of ways, got huger during the pandemic?
Yeah, there's no question. This is one that's going to be studied for quite some time. It's interesting from the perspective that this was a total grassroots effort that didn't really receive any support from any of the major established unions in the United States and Canada. We call them international unions, but they're unions that represent workers in both the U.S. and Canada. And yeah, they cracked the code by, in essence, doing what unions have always done successfully, which is build community from the bottom up and, you know, join together with a common goal of trying to improve their workplace and their working conditions. I mean, that, you know, COVID was kind of the genesis of all of that. It's clear that, you know, I guess I would say that they're at the end of the beginning. The thing that I'm watching for is, yes, they were very successful. Obviously, they succeeded where no one else has in terms of getting a majority of the workers to vote affirmatively that they wanted to form a union. Now their challenge is going to be getting Amazon, once all these challenges and the appeals are done, getting Amazon to the table and trying to bargain this first contract. Because in the United States, that's a daunting hurdle for any union, let alone an independent union.
We've seen over time, despite some of these successful unionizing efforts, a decline in the overall percentage of the workforce unionized in the United States. Right to work laws in many states, now including Wisconsin, and things like Act 10 for public employees in Wisconsin, make it harder maybe to get back into that. Do you see that trend, that decline in percent of the workforce unionized, ever going back up in the immediate or near-term future?
I would say, you know, consistently, most of the academics have stated that, you know, there's other models out there from other countries, whether we look at sector bargaining or bargaining in a more broad base for the community. It's called bargaining for the common good. And you look at some of the unions that have been successful doing that. I'm thinking of the teachers back in 2019 when in West Virginia and many other states, you know, not to mention just down south of here in Chicago, the Chicago teachers had some pretty good success with community partnerships and trying to achieve both, you know, bargaining goals for them, but in general, goals that were trying to help their broader communities. As far as the actual union density numbers changing, time will tell. I mean, there's definitely been a surge in representative elections petitions filed with the NLRB. I mean, a lot of this driven, like you said, by the barista movement, but I think elsewhere as well. And yeah, again, it remains to be seen how successful or how sustainable this is in the longer term. But it's certainly the case that there's been a resurgence in interest, and especially in even the popular, like I said, kind of the zeitgeist now. It's almost like for the younger generation, there's a curiosity that unions are cool now.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. Take care.
That's Michael Childers, professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison, with us for a look at unions, Starbucks, and beyond. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, when you take a job, buy stuff, even use a website, you might have to do mandatory binding arbitration. Find out what it means for you tomorrow on the Ideas Network. Are you a thrift store shopper? If you're a regular, you may have a favorite memory of a fantastic find, something you got for a big bargain. A thrift shopper in Texas got something special, a piece of sculpture that was 2,000 years old. As reported by the Washington Post, the shopper, who works with antiques, thought she'd found something kind of special for $35, a real marble bust in the style of the Roman Empire. She thought, maybe it's a reconstruction of that Roman style. With some expert help, though, nope, it was the real deal, 2 millennia old. Now, she didn't get rich from the sculpture. It turns out the provenance, as they call it, was sketchy. The piece was looted from a German museum after World War II. The bust will spend some time at a San Antonio museum before returning to Germany. Incidentally, it's not clear who the original bust was based on in Roman times, but our shopper nicknamed it Dennis in the meantime. Always a bargain. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back.